Hello, Houston. I just wanted to review a homework assignment with you that you may remember me giving you a couple of lectures back. You'll remember that we talked about a homework assignment that I wanted you to do. I didn't think you were going to be able to do it, but you were up to snap and willing to give it a try. So today is test day. Pop quiz for you. We're going to show you something, and we want to see what you do or don't think of. The object I'm going to show you is a fine, red, delicious apple. And you will remember that your homework assignment, should you have chosen to try to do it foolishly, was that you were not to think of
orange.
Right, this. So you flunk. Anybody who thought of orange now has failed to do that homework assignment. Remember, I said apple is not to elicit orange in your mind. In the classroom, how many of you here can honestly say that you did not think of an orange once I brought out this apple? Were you in class the day that I gave the apple? I thought so. Okay. Well, in essence, what we've illustrated there, well, I won't now. What I've essentially illustrated there is SS, or stimulus-stimulus learning, or linkage, I should say, a link between a stimulus object, apple, and a stimulus object, orange. And your homework assignment, should you choose to remember to do it, is if I show you an apple, you are not to think of an orange, as you didn't. So you get an A this time, but I'll bet you I give you an F next time. We'll see. We'll see. Okay. A man in his early 20s goes to a scintillating X-rated movie on a Friday night and sees techniques of lovemaking that he does not think are physiologically possible. That evening, to his own astonishment and satisfaction and his partner's, he demonstrates that, in fact, the impossible is possible. The type of learning that we're dealing with there is what's called observational learning. Back in the mid-70s, Patricia Hearst, the very famous daughter of a very famous publisher in San Francisco, was kidnapped. And the net result was that the multi-million dollar demand for that return of that child actually resulted in demands ranging from $1 to $20 million in a wave of kidnappings that happened worldwide in the weeks following the kidnapping of Patricia Hearst. You're hammering a nail and you hit your thumb. On a Sunday afternoon, you utter a carefully chosen series of four-letter words. Should you be surprised on the following Thursday afternoon when your young daughter, your darling young daughter, is unable to solve a jigsaw puzzle, can't get a piece to fit, and all of a sudden you hear her uttering exactly the same carefully chosen four-letter words? All of those are examples of what we call observational learning. And that's going to be basically our subject today, is the study of observational learning. We're going to find this is the series of research studies that basically led to a re-examination of the role of reinforcement in learning. And we're going to find that, in fact, that role is relatively minimal. Or the positive way to put it is that a surprising amount of learning can take place for no obvious reinforcer at all. And we'll show you exactly how that was done. The original series of studies here was done by Albert Bandura in his research labs at Stanford University. And in fact, probably if there's a single study that started this area of observational learning, it is the one that I am about to describe to you here. In this study, what they did in Bandura's experiment was to have, first of all, a phase one. It's going to be a four-phase experiment before we get done with it. In this first area or first portion of the study, four different groups of youngsters were exposed to one of four different activities. And each youngster in the experiment was essentially the same age as the model who was actually performing in the movie that these youngsters watched. One of the groups of youngsters watched a movie, well, in fact, three of the four involved the model interacting with what is called a Boppo doll. It's got various names depending on which one you use, but essentially the Boppo doll is a plastic toy that blows up to about off the floor, about 3.5, 4 feet maybe. It's plastic, it's air blown, and it's got sand in the bottom. So if you hit it, it'll rock down, but the sand is heavy enough that it causes it to stand right back upright, okay? So that's the other component of this experiment, is what the model, the 10 or 11-year-old, does to the Boppo doll. In group one, in essence, what the models looked at was a situation where the Bappo doll was slugged. That is, the model simply reared back and hit the Bappo doll. The Bappo doll tipped down to the ground, came right back up and smashed the kid in the face. The kid dissolved in tears. Now, it was a little bit overplayed, but we're dealing with 10 or 11-year-olds here. And so the net result was, in that case, the aggression had clearly been punished. That is, the kid had been smacked in the face by this Bappo doll. In the second situation, the Bappo doll was swung at, and it collapsed. That is, they had a way to let the air out of it very, very rapidly. So when the model swung at the Bappo doll, the second group of youngsters saw this Bappo doll actually collapse in a heap on the floor. So in that case, aggression was not punished. It was, in fact, rewarded. That is, it had the intended effect. In the third situation, the third group of children, the model took a swing at the Bappo doll, and in this case, he was standing far enough back from the Bappo doll that it went down and came right back upright and centered itself. No harm, no foul, no contact at all. The fourth group did not see a film, but simply was engaged in activity that was roughly comparable to what those in the movie situation were looking at. Now, what do we find? Well, in phase two, what we're now going to do is to allow the models to interact with a series of toys. So having watched a movie, they're now moved into a second room where they have a whole series of toys that they can play with, including the Bappo doll that was just in the movie. So there are quite a variety of nice, rich toys to play with, and the Bappo doll. The Bappo doll was the one that the researchers were interested in, because what they did was to keep a tally of the number of instances of aggression that the children in each of those groups registered against the Bappo doll. So if there's any act that would be on a playground be considered an aggressive act, it was tallied and then totaled for the group that was involved. So there were three groups that had previously seen a film with a model interacting with a Bappo doll, and one that was a control group that saw comparable activity but did not actually see an interaction with the Bappo doll. And what do we find? Well, amazingly enough, for the various groups that we're talking about, the group that saw aggression punished manifested relatively few acts of aggression against the Bappo doll. Interestingly enough, even this group, however, aggressed significantly more against the Bappo doll than the group on the right, which was our control group. That is, the control group saw no interaction with the Bappo doll at all, aggressive or otherwise, but simply similarly active interaction with people on the film that were being watched. So relative to the control group, the group that saw punishment exhibited a significantly greater amount of punishment than the group that had not previously seen it modeled. The second group was the one that saw the punishment rewarded or reinforced. That is, in that case, the kid won the fight, if you want to think about it that way, by interacting with the Bappo doll. And thirdly, then, the group that saw no consequence actually found or exhibited almost as many aggressive interactions with the group as had the one that had seen the aggression rewarded. That finding is one that led to some reconsideration of whether reinforcement is really necessary in order for learning to occur, because the two groups are significantly different, but both groups in the middle there, the one that saw aggression rewarded and the one that saw it have no consequence, are manifesting a significantly greater number of aggressive responses than either of the other two groups. And finally then, we have the control group, as I said earlier, that exhibited relatively little aggression. Now we go to phase three. And in phase three, what we're going to do is to show the model in a testing situation, but now the model is going to be asked to, well, essentially each kid, regardless of which group they're in, they were brought into the experimental interview room, and they were asked essentially, show me ways to be aggressive against the Bappo doll. If you wanted to be mean to the Bappo doll, what could you do? But there was no reward. That is, it was simply like youngsters sitting across the desk from a researcher, and they were being asked, how could you be mean to the Bappo doll? And the results in that case were also quite illuminating. What was found was that the group that had previously seen aggression punished showed about 1.5 aggressive responses. And what that means is two kids could manifest about 3 aggressive responses between them. Okay. And so the average youngster could do about 1.5 aggressive responses if they were from the group that had previously seen the model punished, or the aggression punished. Secondly, for the group that saw the aggression rewarded, they could generate about 2.5 responses. That is, two kids could manifest about five aggressive responses in this group. Okay, a significantly greater number. Look at what happens for the group that saw the aggression have no consequence. They could also model almost as many, about 2.4 responses relative to the 2.5. That is a non-significant difference. So that basically what we're concluding here between the second and the third group is that whether you've seen aggression rewarded or seen it had no consequence at all, the amount of learning that has occurred is essentially identical. Okay? Okay, so far. But Bandura really made this an elegant experiment by adding yet a fourth group, a fourth phase to the experiment. In phase four, what he did was to interview the same kids. That is, he followed up with a second half, and that was essentially, for every aggressive act you can show me against the Bapo Dal, I'll give you some M&Ms. Now there was some very immediate currency which was relevant to kids that they like, that is candy. When the candy was available, that is when they were now going to be rewarded for acting aggressively, notice what happens. The punished group, just shy of four average per kid, four aggressive responses could be modeled. For the rewarded group, slightly less, about 3.6, 3.7, 3.8. For the no consequences group, about 3.8. Essentially no significant difference among the three groups when there was a reward for showing how to be aggressive against the Bapo Dal. The point being that, and again it comes back to, I'm making a couple of points here relative to what I've talked about in this section of the course so far. The one is that in essence the performance now is beginning to reflect the learning that actually occurred. That is, once there is an incentive to actually aggress against the Bapo Dal, now suddenly all those abilities spring forth. The youngsters can, in fact, they're non-significantly different as to how nasty they can be to the Bapo Dal. And in fact, the effect of the films was relatively short-lived. But as soon as there was incentive to act in a particular way, hey, I can do that, regardless of which film I'd seen previously. Which leads to a couple of rather interesting observations. Number one, I think you and I as a society vastly underestimate the power of television. Witness the fact that we are educating one another here via television to a certain extent. Secondly, President Reagan, in one of his enlightened acts, appointed a commission to study television during the time he was president. And that commission reported back after a couple of years. Reagan ultimately rejected it. Essentially, my mind is made up. Don't confuse me with facts. But one of the things that commission reported was that the average youngster who graduates high school has spent more time in front of a television set from the time they entered school, whether in kindergarten or first grade, and the time they graduate high school. The average high school graduate has spent more time watching television than they have in the classroom since entering the school system. I think we vastly underestimate the power of television in our society. A couple of examples. You may remember a television show a number of years ago called CHIPS, California Highway Patrol. It was run nationally for several years and then, of course, went into syndication. They eventually ran out of storylines, as such series tend to do, so they started focusing on two kinds of dramas: massive automobile accidents and psychological drama. Well, in the one that I remember and want to use here as an example, they actually did both. They started with a massive tin bender fandango and then followed up with 45 minutes of psychological drama. So they killed two birds with one stone. In this program, they were just driving along on the interstate just when a 40-car pileup occurred in front of them. And of course, they were there. So they got to the head of the mess and discovered that the lead driver had caused this crash because he had a bullet in his head. That took about 5 minutes. The next obvious question is, gee, I wonder how that driver got a bullet in his head. Took about 10 minutes to figure out that there was, beside the freeway, just before where the accident occurred, a kid, a 10 or 11-year-old kid, shooting a rifle at a target into a hay bale. But the hay bale was right next to the highway, so the kid was firing crosswise at the highway, and the story was that he'd missed the target and nailed this driver. Quite an accident, but just an accident. That's 8:15. We've still got 45 minutes of television to solve, to fill. Never stops Ponch and John, the characters. They then started asking the next obvious question. Well, why is this kid unattended in a field shooting a gun at traffic? Took about 20 minutes to work out the fact that he was part of a family which was in the process of breaking up. Husband and wife were falling out of love with each other and going through a divorce. 11-year-old was being widely ignored. Tragedy. Of course, Ponch and John, just as we would expect the police in this city to do, stepped right in and started fixing up the family, doing good solid family therapy, talking to the parents, figure out what the problems were, work to correct the problems, get the kid re-involved in what the parents are doing. They went to YMCA meetings, they went to religious meetings, all sorts of things. Last shot in the program then, here is this 11-year-old kind of squinched between a mother and father who are arm and shoulder around each other, headed off to the range to put the target where it should have been, against a bank, and do things safely and under supervision. So it was a classic middle-class America success story, which played on Thursday night in this country. Saturday morning, I swear, there was an article in the Houston paper here that a 12-year-old had been arrested in Dallas, sitting on a bridge, shooting at cars on one of the expressways in Dallas. A direct example of, I saw it Thursday night, I'm going to try it Saturday morning. And it worked. He killed two people. Another example, NBC was the first network to do a national retrospective on the Vietnam conflict after we got out of it. And within that, they showed, among other things, monks that immolated themselves. That is, one of the things that happened was that in Thailand, because the war began to expand and lap over into and mess up Thailand's economy also, the monks in Thailand began dousing themselves in kerosene and then flaming themselves. That is, literally immolating themselves. Very nasty kind of stuff. This program started at 10 o'clock in the evening in Boston on WBZ, the NBC outlet there. And by about 10:45, police had a report that some thugs had accosted a group of high school students walking home from a high school activity in the Back Bay region, and in fact had isolated one of the young ladies in the group, poured gasoline on her, and set her afire. And the only thing that kept her from being killed was the fact that her friends were with her and they were able to roll her in the sand and the dirt in the street and get the flames put out and then go get help. And that was what ultimately saved her, but she was seriously disfigured. And in the trial that followed, the parents sued NBC and WBZ and the parents of the perpetrators who were caught. And in the trial, it was revealed by the thugs that in fact they had been watching the NBC news program and had seen the monks immolating themselves and decided they wanted to go out and try it and see if it would actually work. And lo and behold, it did. But again, it's a case of where it was observational learning without thought taken right out and applied on the streets. I would argue that one of the major reasons why our country continues to function as well as it does, and there's certainly room for improvement, is the fact that the economy works. That is, there's no incentive to create mayhem. But have you noticed how rapidly, when something deteriorates in a city, how rapidly there are many, many people there to break store windows and steal stuff? Because when the rewards are there, we all know how to do it. We have seen time and again, the President's Commission even 20 years ago estimated that the average television viewer has seen something like 30,000 murders during the accumulated time of watching television. So those skills have been communicated, and we have observational learning to thank for it. So I would just caution you to be careful of what you do relative to television watching and exercise some active monitoring of what your young ones are doing, because the effect is pretty clearly there in terms of ability to impact what our viewers are actually doing. I just wanted to come back to the study and point out to you the amount of change that exists simply by adding the reward. That is, the difference between the green and the red line is a difference in performance attributable strictly to adding a reward to the red line performance. And that's the only difference. The learning was clearly there when they were tested without the reward. They just didn't bother to perform it. They didn't bother to show what they could in fact do. But as soon as there is a reinforcement, bang, the behavior is there right away. Scary, if you think about it. Remember this problem? I gave it to you way back on day one. We'll show you here the power of observational learning. How many of you in the studio can actually do this problem? The idea was to connect these 9 dots with 4 straight lines without taking your pencil off the paper once you start drawing. Can anybody do it? I see no hands, so I'll get typically about 1, 2, 3% response here. It does turn out to be fairly easy to do. You simply start in the bottom right and draw to the upper left. Then we're going to take a sharp left-hand turn, and we're going to draw not to, but beyond the bottom left dot. We're going to take another sharp left turn, and we're going to draw through 2 more dots. And now the rest is easy. We're going to take another sharp left turn and come home. Didn't think it could be done, did you? You thought I'd lied to you, created an impossible problem? Not at all. I was teaching a class at a local college one night in summer, a 3-hour class. It was just a tragedy. There was a woman on the front row of the class because I posed this problem at the beginning of this 3-hour class, 6:30 on a summer evening. And she sat down idly with a pad of paper in front of her, and she decided she was going to solve all the problems. And the net result was that she went through 5 pages of paper doing the 9 dots and then trying all different combinations of lines. And pretty soon the pencil marks were heavier and heavier and heavier. And pretty soon she was not just making dots, she was drilling holes in the paper as she put the 9 dots in there. The point is that this is a tricky problem. And I have a strong feeling, I don't know for sure, but I have a strong feeling that this is where the saying, think outside the box, may actually have come from. Because this is quite a famous problem-solving task, and it's often used early on in seminars involving strategies for creative thinking. And in fact, you can solve this problem very easily, but you can't. Most of you wrote for yourself a rule which was not in the rules I gave you almost as soon as I gave you the problem. And that is, you said to yourself, you've got to do it within the box. And I never said that. All I said was, you've got to connect with 4 straight lines without taking your pencil off the paper once you start drawing. And that's all I said. But most of you drew yourself or created that extra rule and hindered your ability to solve the problem. And the point is that you need to literally step outside the box, think of other ways to respond to it that are legal. And the one that I've just given you on screen clearly is. Now, at this point, what we're going to do is to make a fairly significant shift into looking at, or we're going to ease our way into today, looking at what is called cognitive psychology, or specifically human learning in the context of modern-day findings related to cognitive psychology. Traditionally, in human learning, the early studies of this activity share certain similarities. There are certain distinctions that exist, and there are certain actual out-and-out differences that exist between cognitive approaches to the study of human learning and those that are done by traditional studies of human learning. The central issue in human learning traditionally is essentially how much. It's essentially a quantitative approach to the issue. How much can I learn? How long can I remember it? How much can I recall? And so forth. Emphasis is on amount learned, amount forgotten, and so forth. The stimuli that are normally used are nonsense syllables, which I'll talk about here in a little bit, and we tend to measure either the number of items remembered or the number of items recognized or something like that. That's what is called the Ebbinghaus tradition. And in fact, his work started way back in 1885. He was among the very first true experimental psychologists. And he started out by memorizing lists of nonsense syllables and really held sway in terms of how psychology studied human behavior, human learning behavior, I should say, up until about 1970 or 1975. And the kind of emphasis that he put on it was essentially to emphasize quantitative changes, as I was saying. And the primary thing that he invented or contributed here, other than the study techniques, were nonsense syllables. What he did basically was, it was kind of an interesting idea and an unusual way to go about it. What he tried to do was create material which was verbal but devoid of meaning. I'm sure you've been in classes that involved a lot of verbal material that was devoid of meaning, but Ebbinghaus actually set out deliberately to do that. And what he invented were what are called nonsense syllables. And these are normally, I mean, there are a variety of ways to do it, but normally they are what are called CVCs, or consonant, vowel, consonant combinations. My initials, Richard A. Cash, R-A-K, for most of you would simply be a nonsense syllable. It's a consonant, a vowel, a consonant. He studied lists of these, and then tried to track his retention of them over a period of up to as much as a month, as we'll see in the next lecture. But the emphasis there was on things like number of items retained, decrease in number of errors, and so forth. And as I said earlier, he was essentially emphasizing the quantitative changes that took place in learning, the quantitative aspects or limits of how well we could learn and how well we could retain. The image that comes to mind there, and we have Ebbinghaus to thank for this, is the idea of memory essentially as a mailbox storage system, where when you have something you've, quotes, learned and stored, it's just stuck in a mailbox, and when you need it, you pull it out, you unfold it, and you take the information from it that you need it. I'm going to show you some demonstrations later which argue against that model. But it held sway for about 3/4 of a century, and we have Ebbinghaus, I think, originally to thank for this. The second was the work of Bartlett, whose original experiment was actually done way back in the 1930s, but it wasn't until the middle 70s that we really began to understand, that by we, what I mean is psychologists, really began to understand what Bartlett had actually demonstrated. I'll show you that actual experiment at the beginning of the next segment of material. But in essence, the original work was done in 1932. It awaited the work of Beth Loftus at the University of Washington in 1974, before modern-day psychology actually began to understand what Bartlett had actually demonstrated. But his emphasis was really much more on qualitative changes in learning. The kind of question that he was trying to answer is essentially, how do we approach the task? What kind of similarities show up in the way you process something and the way I process something? If I were to give you a word list of things like Pontiac, Oak, Petunia, Dodge, Pine, Rose, and so forth, you would not call it back to me in the list of Pontiac, I can't remember the order, Oak, Petunia, but rather you would give me Pontiac, Dodge, Plymouth, Ford, and so forth, and then you'd give me the flowers, and then you'd give me the trees. In other words, you and I categorize or cluster information based on similarity. That was something that Bartlett picked up on. That is the idea that in fact we can engage material, and we don't necessarily feed it back in the way we get it. We actively process it. The concerns for Bartlett were essentially, what is the impact that our learning has on the material that we actually master or try to master? So he approached the issue in a very different way. For instance, what's the next word on this list? If iris is number one, what's the second word on this list?
Cornea.
Get on the microphone.
Cornea?
Cornea, no. No. Actually, it's carnation. If it's iris, then carnation. What's the next one?
Petunia.
Azaleas.
Orchid. Azaleas. That's one I didn't think of. Actually, it was zinnia, and then it was petunia, and then it was daffodil. I had a kind of a dry evening when I was trying to put these together. What's the next one? Yes, actually, it was a rose, which somebody just said but wasn't on microphone and thus didn't get credit for. Take my word, America, they did say rose. You notice when we were listening for possible guesses, and for those of you at home, when you were thinking of possible guesses, I'll bet not a one of you thought to scream out Buick, because in essence that would be a violation of the concept that all of these terms clearly share in common. It has never been mentioned. But in fact, when we did this, it was immediately obvious after number two. Iris was ambiguous, and I chose it deliberately. And sure enough, one of you was cued to think of I terms, and others of you may have also done so. But in essence, once the second one came up, there were no more guesses that I heard sitting here from the 70 people in the room. All right, 60. There was a flower name. There was anything other than a flower name, okay? And a car name or a tree just would not have happened because you very quickly narrowed in on what the concept was. That's essentially a Bartlettian, if I can use that word, contribution. The idea that you and I do things with words over and above the purely quantitative aspects that Ebbinghaus himself was trying to cite. So that basically the other guesses that we get tend to be drawn from words like the ones that I put on the screen here now, and I'll have to add the others that were suggested there, like, in fact, I did have dandelion. I'm so proud. How about this one? Here's another way to organize it. What's the next word? What is the next word here?
Oops.
Buick. No. What's the next word?
Can,
of course. And then? And you're right, yes, it's by. But you notice immediately in two words, it took a little while, but even in two words you had the correct answer there. That's another way of organizing, which is a serial form, but it still involves a degree of retention and cognitive application. That is that you've put it away, you've rehearsed it often enough at ballparks and games and various graduation ceremonies that you know the words to the national anthem. Okay? That's another way to memorize it. We've not, in that case, done it conceptually. We've done it in a serial manner. Okay? But it is still a quantitative shift, a qualitative shift that we've made in storing that as a unit. And you could do a pretty good job of filling in. If I asked you to write down the words of the national anthem with a little bit of mixing, you could probably end up producing a pretty close approximation to what we were just talking about there. And sure enough, the answer is bye, so that you don't go home and worry about this tonight. Now, when we look at human verbal learning, I want to step back and show you how we got to where we are by looking first at some of the procedures that Ebbinghaus originally introduced, because he did introduce some important early findings in our understanding of modern-day human learning. One of the things that he did was to understand show for us two different major ways of measuring human learning. The traditional, most often used way is to measure the number of correct responses. And here, a trial is essentially just one complete repetition through a list. So if I'm actually asking you to learn a list of 12 items, a trial in this context would be one exposure to each of the terms. So that once you've seen all of the terms one time and been tested, that's a trial for Ebbinghaus's purposes. And in essence, what he's able to demonstrate is that we have a negatively accelerating curve here, as it's technically called. But in essence, we have very rapid growth at the beginning, and then it slopes off gradually to a lower and lower rate of approaching perfection. Okay, but the number of correct responses clearly goes up as we learn. The other way to measure it instead is to measure number of errors. And when we do that, you get the reverse. That is, the number of errors with each trial will tend to drop. Or I should do it that way to be parallel to the curve on screen there. In essence, it drops. And those are the traditional measures that are used, either number correct or number missed in the performance curves that are normally used. Ebbinghaus also introduced several different techniques for studying information. The one with which he's best associated is what's called serial learning. A serial list, your name is a serial list. That is, learning that material to say your name, to spell your name, we have to do a particular set of letters, and there is only one order that is acceptable, okay? What's on your birth certificate or whichever alias you're using now. But that's the only one that is acceptable, okay? So serial learning is what's involved there. In this case, on the computer screen, what we would do the first time is to put a series of asterisks. That cues you that we are starting the list, okay? And then the first word shows up, and what we're using here is serial learning. So the word cherry, which is the first word on our list, shows up in the screen. It will be there for perhaps 2 seconds. And then in traditional serial learning, the next word shows up, grape. And that will be there for 2 seconds. Now, this gets to be fairly confusing learning when we try to sort out what is actually going on, because the task that you and I face is pretty straightforward. That is, what's going to happen to us is we're going to be shown each of these terms one at a time, and our goal is to use each term as the stimulus to cue what the next term is. So the problem that we have in trying to sort out what's actually going on here is, for instance, cherry at the beginning of the list is first of all a stimulus for grape, but grape then is first a response and then becomes a stimulus. So in essence, each word in turn is a response, as cherry was to the asterisk, and grape then becomes the response to cherry while cherry is a stimulus. And so the point is that it gets to be fairly confusing to try to sort out the relationships that exist. And there have been studies even suggesting that there are remote associations, even linking words at the beginning of the list to words at the end of the list. Weaker, certainly, than the ones listing the first to the second word. But it gets to be a fairly complex study process, even in looking at something like serial learning. Any song like the national anthem is a serial list. Your name, the days of the week, the alphabet, the number series, 1, 2, 3, 4. Remember how agonizing it was? You may have watched a younger brother or sister learn to count. Do you remember how agonizing it was early on? I mean, to you it was easy. 4. It's hard. But convincing them that there's any relationship between 4 and 14 takes some effort. But once they catch that, once they can do 1 to 10 or 1 to 20, they're off. And then you have to sit there and listen to them go to 393, which is boring. But in essence, they've learned the cycle. And once they've learned it, as we now know, it's much easier to apply it. But that's a serial learning task that is essentially going on there. There's a very interesting phenomenon that comes out of the learning of serial lists. And that is what we call the serial position effect. It is the case that in listening, when you go to a sports arena and they sing the national anthem, nobody, but nobody, screws up on "O Say Can You See." Okay, if you know anything about the national anthem, you can sing "O Say Can You See" by dawn's early light. It's when you get down into trying to keep rockets' red glare and next morning's light straight that things begin to foul up. And in fact, what happens is that if we plot the learning of a standard serial list with just a set number of items, the easiest item on the entire list is the last item. And what's happening there at the end of the list, the reason there is that upturn at the end of the list, is because you're dumping out of short, what we're going to call here shortly, short-term memory. That is, the words that you have just seen, if you're then given free recall, are the first ones you kick out, and therefore you tend to do very well on them. The longer ones, the second most efficiently recalled word, the second easiest to learn, is the first item on the list. That's coming out of long-term memory, because normally what happens is you over-rehearse the first items. And even though they may be showing the words one at a time, when we show you 12 words in a row that you haven't seen previously, there's a point at which you get overloaded. And what do you do then? You sit there, you say the words, but you sit there and rehearse the first ones. And so the net result is the first ones get massively over-rehearsed, performance improves at the beginning of the list. So in essence, we get a serial position curve. If you don't believe it, ask somebody today, later today, ask a friend to spell for you convenience and listen, first of all, to where the first error occurs, because that turns out to be a very hard word for humans to spell. And secondly, listen to the order, in the speed with which they emit the letters. Because I'll bet you what you're going to find is what's called bursting. You will hear C-O-N, and if they know the word, it will then be V-E-N. Then there'll be a pause longer than existed between C-O-N and V-E-N, and then if they're lucky, they'll spell out the rest of it for you. But otherwise, that's where it will begin to break down. Okay, somewhere around the midpoint. Try it later and just listen and demonstrate for yourself the existence of the serial position curve. Now, in addition to serial learning, we can also utilize what is called paired associate learning. This is essentially what you do when you're learning a foreign language. The way we do it by computer would be to put, first of all, a nonsense syllable on the word. Now, this is not a nonsense syllable for me, but it is for you because it's not your initials. They are my initials, but I couldn't think of a better one. So this is a CVC combination. It's our stimulus, which cues that in this particular case, we're going to do paired associate learning. And what we're going to do then is to put each of these terms in a row on the screen one at a time. So RAK is there. Now we're going to put instead RAK dog. Okay, so for 2 seconds, you look just at the stimulus, the cue term. Then for 2 seconds, the correct response is paired with it. So you are supposed to learn RAK means dog in that case. I should have used cats because I really like cats better, but roll with me on this. Next, we're going to put up XIL, and then we're going to put up XIL cat. And then we're going to put up CEH, and then we're going to put up CEH bird, and so forth. Now, after one time through this list, what we're then going to do, and again, it's 2 seconds a time, so actually we're studying, testing, all the way through. Testing is very different here than it is in the serial list, because you're not studying, testing simultaneously. You are studying and then tested, studying and then tested. In essence, after we've gone through the list one time, one trial, now what we do is to rearrange the pairs. In this case, XIL will always be associated with cat. But if it was the second item in this list, it may be the ninth item in our 12-pair list on the next time through. RAK dog may be the seventh item. The third one here may become the first one, and so forth. In other words, they will be re-randomized before they're presented to you again. Why do we do that? In paired associate learning, why do we mix the pairs? Think of it another way. What are we preventing by mixing the pairs?
Serial learning?
Yes, exactly. That is, if we don't have you, if we don't force you to learn them by pairs, you don't even need the stimulus terms. All you'd have to do is, if we gave you the pairs in the same order every single time, all you'd have to learn is dog, cat, bird, and whatever else follows. Okay? So in order to force the learning by pairs, the pairs themselves remain constant. But in fact, they will be randomized in the order in which they are presented to you. By exactly the same logic, if you're mastering a foreign language, you do not take the cards and always go through them in the same order. You put Spanish on one side and English on the other, or your native language on one side, and whatever you're trying to learn is the translation on the other side. And you don't go through them in the same order every time. The whole reason they're put on cards is so that you can shuffle them. The idea being that you're trying to force yourself to learn them not in a particular order, but rather as a paired linkage. Okay. Now, beyond paired associative learning, there's a third type that is not used frequently, and that is what's called free recall learning. What we do here is to give you the entire list. And if it's a 12-item list, I've only used 8 to illustrate here, but if it's a 12-item list, we give you that list for 24 seconds. We give you it for typically twice as long in seconds as there are items on the list, and then the whole list goes away, and you then have a block of 24 seconds in which you can engage in free recall. And as you might expect, what we find happens is that subjects, if we listen to what they're doing, will sit there and go stone, stone flower, stone flower mallet, stone flower mallet boat. And they will rehearse each time from the beginning and go as far as they can. The net result is that this kind of approach significantly increases the serial position effect. Because what happens is you and I will massively over-rehearse the early items, and we kick out the last items, if at all, only from short-term memory because we happen to remember them. But in fact, we basically, psychologists lose control over what subjects do for rehearsal in this kind of a presentation. And so traditionally, this has not been used very much in a learning situation. But this is what's called free recall learning. Now, there are a number of different factors that influence how well we can learn material. Number one, and without doubt the most powerful, is meaningfulness. And there are a lot of different ways to define the meaningfulness of a term. One of the easiest ways is to measure what is called association value. In association value, if I were going to measure the association value of a word to you, what I would do is give you a list of words, one per sheet. And when you turned the sheet, there'd be a word like kitchen on that sheet. And your challenge would be to write every word that my word made you think of. And in essence, what we're measuring there are associations. How many associations or links does my word call up for you? Kitchen turns out to be a particularly rich one. Refrigerator, stove, oven, sink, dishes, cooking, silverware, you know, you name it. It's a very rich association generator. Okay? That's a high association value word. In fact, if we were to put you in a research situation, memorizing serial words or serial lists, we would be able to demonstrate, in fact, that with a 12-item serial list, most people can learn the list in fewer recitations than there are items in the list. For the average among us, it wouldn't take us 10 recitations to have it down perfectly, as long as we're using words like army, kitchen, youngster, all of which are high association value words. If we do a medium association value word, we're using a word like naphtha. How many of you know the most common household product that's made out of naphtha? Mothballs. Mothballs are made out of naphtha. Now you're thinking to yourself, if naphtha is a medium association value word, what the heck is a low association value word? Well, that's a word like volvap or neglen. You're familiar with those words, of course. And you shouldn't be, because they're nonsense words. They are words the spelling of which follows the standard rules of what letter can and can't follow what other letter, but they are not words. And it turns out, if I've actually run subjects where there was a 12-item nonsense syllable list or nonsense word like volvap and neglen, we would terminate people after between 150 and 200 trials, complete recitations through the list at 2 seconds a term, an hour or more. They couldn't learn it. When the association value is low or non-existent, it is a very difficult learning situation. Okay? So association value very clearly has an impact on ease of learning. And association value is but one among several measures of the meaningfulness of material. Secondly, we can measure, or the frequency of a word, which we can measure, impacts ease of learning. The higher frequency a word is, that is per standard sample of English, the more often the word appears, the easier it is to learn. Interestingly enough, the more often a word is used in our language, the shorter it is. And you and I, as language speakers, will edit our vocabulary. When television was originally introduced, it had some very fancy three-word label, which I've long since forgotten, like electronic signal projection or something like that. That would be ESP, and I'm sure that wasn't it, but it was a long technical definition. That was substituted for television. Television, in turn, was shortened to telly in Great Britain, to TV in this country, and about 10 years ago, all of a sudden, we started having it or hearing it be called the V. I'm going to go home and watch the V. Somebody said that to you, you knew exactly what they were going to do. Okay? Again, because as the frequency goes up, all right, so I chose a dated example. That did happen. Trust me. But in any case, at least down through, you do understand TV, don't you? I want to make sure you're with me at least through most of the examples. Okay, the point is that when a word's frequency goes up, we shorten it. We just do. It used to be a gas-powered vehicle. Then it became an automobile or a self-powered automobile, and now it's a car. It was an auto, and then it became a car. So again, the shortening is there. I'm dallying. In any case, as frequency goes up, ease of learning goes up. A third factor is imagery value. The reason I did the apple test earlier is that apple is a classic example of a very high imagery value word. I dare say almost every one of you had in mind an image for an apple when I was mentioning it, like the red one that I was using there, not because I chose that, but that's the kind of prototypic example of an apple. And that's the one that most of us tend to think of when we think of apple. You could just as easily think of a Granny Smith, which is green and just as delicious, but we don't tend to. We tend to think of the apple as a red object. But almost all of us have some kind of an image in our mind that's very close and would easily be recognized if any of the rest of us could look in and see it. Not so with a word like truth. Truth is a high association value word, but it's a very low imagery value word. Interestingly enough, if we hold association value constant, we can vary imagery value and have a huge impact on ease of learning. In a paired associate task, if we use only high imagery value words, we can create a very easy task for learning and recall. On this task, reciting a list to one perfect recitation in paired associate learning, when both terms were of high imagery value, performance was close to 100% correct for the group by the end of learning, and in recall later. For a group that was low imagery, low association value, it was only about half. They could only recall slightly less than half when they had a low imagery value stimulus being used to cue a low imagery value response. The interesting group are the two in the middle. The average imagery value for both lists in the middle of this graph are identical. Okay? But notice the fact how much better we do when we have a high imagery value stimulus term. That leads to better performance. Okay? High imagery value stimulus term leads to better performance. There's a lesson in there about mnemonics, which we'll be talking about in the next lecture. The idea being that the more imagery rich the cueing term is, the better the likelihood you'll be able to recall the term. So when you're creating a mnemonic for yourself, a visual image of some sort, or any kind of a verbal image, it's better to have a high imagery value term that you use to cue the recall that you're interested in. Beyond imagery, we can also look at context. If I were to give you a word association task, I want you to give me the first word that my word makes you think of. Okay? And in essence, what I'm looking for is I want you to associate freely to the third word I give you. Chablis, Sauterne, port. What does port make you think of in that case?
Wine.
Okay. Now instead, what I give you is ocean, ship, port. You think of dock or something like that, typically. In essence, the only thing that has structured port in that case is the context within which it occurs. Interestingly enough, a word like line, a fairly innocuous word, actually has over 50 definitions in Webster's International. There are over 50 definitions for the word line. You throw somebody a line, you hand somebody a line, what is the bottom line, hook, line, and sinker, and on and on and on. In that case, context is really crucial to understanding the meaning of the term. We can then also look at practice techniques, okay? Distributed practice much better than mass practice for retaining information. Okay? It's better to spread your practice out to eliminate effects of boredom and fatigue. Reading versus recitation, it is much more important to recite information than to read it. You should spend more time reciting for an exam than reading, because reading is an input, recitation is an output process. You need to practice the output. Whole versus part learning, it depends on what you're learning. If you're learning the triple Lutz, you can't only practice takeoffs. You really have to do the whole thing. But if you're practicing a piece on the guitar and one bar or one two measure part is giving you troubles, then you want to isolate that and practice it in more detail, and then reintegrate it. Knowledge of results is easy. The more immediate and the more accurate the knowledge of results, the better your learning will be. We'll pick up next time looking at participant variables.